Chapter 28. I hurried down the village street. It was 11 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, the whole village of St. Mary Mead might be dead. I saw, however, a light in a first-floor window as I passed, and realizing that Hawes was still up, I stopped and rang the doorbell. After what seemed a long time, Hawes' landlady, Mrs. Sadler, laboriously unfastened two bolts, a chain, and turned a key and peered out at me suspiciously.
"Why, it's Vicar!"
she exclaimed. "Good evening," I said. "I want to see Mr. Hawes. I see there's a light in the window, so he's up still."
"That may be. I've not seen him since I took up his supper. He's had a quiet evening. No one to see him, and he's not been out."
I nodded, and passing her, went quickly up the stairs. Hawes has a bedroom and sitting room on the first floor. I passed into the latter. Hawes was lying back in a long chair, asleep. My entrance did not wake him. An empty cachet box and a glass of water, half full, stood beside him. On the floor by his left foot was a crumpled sheet of paper with writing on it. I picked it up and straightened it out. It began, "My dear Clement." I read it through, uttered an exclamation, and shoved it into my pocket. Then I bent over Hawes and studied him attentively. Next, reaching for the telephone which stood by his elbow, I gave the number of the vicarage. Melchett must have been still trying to trace the call, for I was told that the number was engaged. Asking them to call me, I put the instrument down again. I put my hand into my pocket to look at the paper I had picked up once more. With it, I drew out the note that I had found in the letterbox, and which was still unopened. Its appearance was horribly familiar. It was the same handwriting as the anonymous letter that had come that afternoon. I tore it open. I read it once, twice, unable to realize its contents. I was beginning to read it a third time when the telephone rang. Like a man in a dream, I picked up the receiver and spoke. "Hello?"
"Hello?"
"Is that you, Melchett?"
"Yes. Where are you? I've traced that call. The number is..."
"I know the number."
"Oh, good. Is that where you're speaking from?"
"Yes."
"What about that confession?"
"I've got the confession, all right."
"You mean you've got the murderer?"
I had then the strongest temptation of my life. I looked at the anonymous scrawl. I looked at the empty cachet box with the name of Cherubim on it. I remembered a certain casual conversation. I made an immense effort.
"I don't know," I said. "You'd better come round."
And I gave him the address. Then I sat down in the chair opposite Hawes to think. I had 2 clear minutes to do so. In 2 minutes' time, Melchett would have arrived. I took up the anonymous letter and read it through again for the third time. Then I closed my eyes and thought. Chapter 29. I don't know how long I sat there. Only a few minutes in reality, I suppose, yet it seemed as though an eternity had passed when I heard the door open, and turning my head, looked up to see Melchett entering the room. He stared at Hawes asleep in his chair, then turned to me.
"What's this, Clement? What does it all mean?"
Of the 2 letters in my hand, I selected one and passed it to him. He read it aloud in a low voice.
"My dear Clement, it is a peculiarly unpleasant thing that I have to say. After all, I think I prefer writing it. We can discuss it at a later date. It concerns the recent peculations. I am sorry to say that I have satisfied myself beyond any possible doubt as to the identity of the culprit. Painful as it is for me to have to accuse an ordained priest of the church, My duty is only too painfully clear. An example must be made, and...
He looked at me questioningly. At this point, the writing tailed off in an undistinguishable scrawl where death had overtaken the writer's hand. Melchett drew a deep breath, then looked at Hawes.
So, that's the solution. The one man we never even considered, and remorse drove him to confess.
He's been very queer lately, I said.
Suddenly, Melchett strode across to the sleeping man with a sharp exclamation. He seized him by the shoulder and shook him, at first gently, then with increasing violence.
He's not asleep. He's drugged. What's the meaning of this?
His eye went to the empty cachet box. He picked it up.
Has he?
I think so, I said. He showed me these the other day. Told me he'd been warned against an overdose. It's his way out, poor chap. Perhaps the best way. It's not for us to judge him.
But Melchett was chief constable of the county before anything else. The arguments that appealed to me had no weight with him. He had caught a murderer, and he wanted his murderer hanged. In 1 second he was at the telephone, jerking the receiver up and down impatiently until he got a reply. He asked for Haydock's number. Then there was a further pause, during which he stood, his ear to the telephone and his eyes on the limp figure in the chair.
Hello! 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 Is that Dr. Haydock's? Will the doctor come round at once to High Street? Mr. Hawes! It's urgent. What's that? Well, what number is it then?
Oh, sorry. He rang off, fuming.
Wrong number! Wrong number! Always wrong numbers! And a man's life hanging on it! Hello! You gave me the wrong number! Yes, don't waste time. Give me 399, not 5.
Another period of impatience, shorter this time.
Hello, is that you, Haydock? Melchett speaking. Come to 19 High Street at once, will you? Hawes has taken some kind of overdose. At once, man, it's vital.
He rang off, strode impatiently up and down the room.
Why on earth you didn't get hold of the doctor at once, Clement, I cannot think. Your wits must have all gone wool-gathering.
Fortunately, it never occurs to Melchett that anyone can possibly have different ideas on conduct to those he holds himself. I said nothing, and he went on.
Where did you find this letter?
Crumpled on the floor, where it had fallen from his hand.
Extraordinary business. That old maid was right about its being the wrong note we found. Wonder how she tumbled to that. But what an ass the fellow was not to destroy this one. Fancy keeping it. The most damaging evidence you can imagine.
Human nature is full of inconsistencies.
If it weren't, I doubt if we should ever catch a murderer. Sooner or later, they always do some fool thing. You're looking very under the weather, Clement. I suppose this has been the most awful shock to you.
It has. As I say, Hawes has been queer in his manner for some time, but I never dreamed.
Who would? Hello, that sounds like a car.
He went across to the window, pushing up the sash and leaning out.
Yes, it's Haydock, all right.
A moment later, the doctor entered the room. In a few succinct words, Melchett explained the situation. Haydock is not a man who ever shows his feelings. He merely raised his eyebrows, nodded, and strode across to his patient. He felt his pulse, raised the eyelid, and looked intently at the eye. Then he turned to Melchett.
"Want to save him for the gallows?" he asked. "He's pretty far gone, you know. It will be touch and go anyway. I doubt if I can bring him round."
"Do everything possible."
"Right."
He busied himself with the case he had brought with him, preparing a hypodermic injection, which he injected into Hawes' arm. Then he stood up. Best thing is to run him into Much Benham, to the hospital there. Give me a hand to get him down to the car. We both lent our assistance. As Haydock climbed into the driving seat, he threw a parting remark over his shoulder. You won't be able to hang him, you know, Melchett.
You mean he won't recover?
May or may not. I didn't mean that. I mean that even if he does recover, well, the poor devil wasn't responsible for his actions. I shall give evidence to that effect.
What did he mean by that?
Asked Melchett as we went upstairs again. I explained that Hawes had been a victim of encephalitis lethargica.
Sleepy sickness, eh? Always some good reason nowadays for every dirty action that's done, don't you agree?
Science is teaching us a lot.
Science be damned. I beg your pardon, Clement, but all this namby-pambyism annoys me. I'm a plain man. Well, I suppose we'd better have a look round here.
But at this moment there was an interruption, and a most amazing one. The door opened, and Miss Marple walked into the room. She was pink and somewhat flustered, and seemed to realise our condition of bewilderment.
So sorry, so very sorry to intrude. Good evening, Colonel Melchett. As I say, I am so sorry, but hearing that Mr. Hawes was taken ill, I felt I must come round and see if I couldn't do something.
She paused. Colonel Melchett was regarding her in a somewhat disgusted fashion.
"Very kind of you, Miss Marple," he said dryly, "but no need to trouble. How did you know, by the way?"
It was the question I had been yearning to ask.
"The telephone," explained Miss Marple. "So careless with their wrong numbers, aren't they? You spoke to me first, thinking I was Dr. Haydock. My number is 35.
"So that was it," I exclaimed. There is always some perfectly good and reasonable explanation for Miss Marple's omniscience.
"And so," she continued, "I just came round to see if I could be of any use."
"Very kind of you," said Melchett again,
even more dryly this time.
"But nothing to be done. Haydock's taken him off to hospital."
"Actually to hospital? Oh, that's a great relief. I'm so very glad to hear it. He'll be quite safe there. When you say nothing to be done, you don't mean that he won't recover."
"It's very doubtful," I said. Miss Marple's eyes had gone to the cachet box.
"I suppose he took an overdose," she said.
Melchett, I think, was in favour of being reticent. Perhaps I might have been under other circumstances, but my discussion of the case with Miss Marple was too fresh in my mind for me to have the same view, though I must admit that her rapid appearance on the scene and eager curiosity repelled me slightly. "You had better look at this," I said, and handed her Prothero's unfinished letter. She took it and read it without any appearance of surprise. "You had already deduced something of the kind, had you not?" I asked.
"Yes, yes indeed. May I ask you, Mr. Clement, what made you come here this evening? That is a point which puzzles me. You and Colonel Melchett, not at all what I should have expected."
I explained the telephone call and that I believed I'd recognised Hawes's voice. Miss Marple nodded thoughtfully.
"Very interesting. Very providential, if I may use the term. Yes, it brought you here in the nick of time."
"In the nick of time for what?" I said bitterly. Miss Marple looked surprised.
"To save Mr. Hawes' life, of course."
"Don't you think," I said, "that it might be better if Hawes didn't recover? Better for him, better for everyone. We know the truth now, and—" I stopped, for Miss Marple was nodding her head with such a peculiar vehemence that it made me lose the thread of what I was saying.
"Of course,"
she said.
Of course. That's what he wants you to think. That you know the truth, and that it's best for everyone as it is. Oh, yes, it all fits in. The letter and the overdose and poor Mr. Hawes' state of mind and his confession. It all fits in. But it's wrong.
We stared at her.
That's why I am so glad Mr. Hawes is safe, in hospital, where no one can get at him. If he recovers, he'll tell you the truth.
The truth?
Yes, that he never touched a hair of Colonel Prothero's head.
But the telephone call, I said. The letter, the overdose, it's all so clear.
That's what he wants you to think. Oh, he's very clever. Keeping the letter and using it this way was very clever indeed.
Who do you mean, I said, by he?
I mean the murderer, said Miss Marple.
She added very quietly,
I mean Mr. Lawrence Redding.
Chapter 30. We stared at her. I really think that for a moment or two, we really believed she was out of her mind. The accusation seemed so utterly preposterous. Colonel Melchett was the first to speak. He spoke kindly and with a kind of pitying tolerance.
That is absurd, Miss Marple, he said. Young Redding has been completely cleared.
Naturally, said Miss Marple. He saw to that.
On the contrary, said Colonel Melchett dryly, he did his best to get himself accused of the murder.
Yes, said Miss Marple. He took us all in that way, myself as much as anyone else. You will remember, dear Mr. Clement, that I was quite taken aback when I heard Mr. Redding had confessed to the crime. It upset all my ideas and made me think him innocent, when up to then I had felt convinced that he was guilty.
Then it was Lawrence Redding you suspected.
I know that in books it is always the most unlikely person, but I never find that rule applies in real life. There it is so often the obvious that is true. Much as I have always liked Mrs. Prothero, I could not avoid coming to the conclusion that she was completely under Mr. Redding's thumb and would do anything he told her, and of course, he is not the kind of young man who would dream of running away with a penniless woman. From his point of view, it was necessary that Colonel Prothero should be removed, and so he removed him. One of those charming young men who have no moral sense.
Colonel Melchett had been snorting impatiently for some time. Now he broke out.
Absolute nonsense, the whole thing. Redding's time is fully accounted for up to 6:50, and Haydock says positively Prothero couldn't have been shot then. I suppose you think you know better than a doctor. Or do you suggest that Haydock is deliberately lying? The Lord knows why.
I think Dr. Haydock's evidence was absolutely truthful. He is a very upright man, and of course it was Mrs. Prothero who actually shot Colonel Prothero, not Mr. Redding.
Again we stared at her. Miss Marple arranged her lace fichu, pushed back the fleecy shawl that draped her shoulders, and began to deliver a gentle old maidish lecture comprising the most astounding statements in the most natural way in the world.
I have not thought it right to speak until now. One's own belief, even so strong as to amount to knowledge, is not the same as proof, and unless one has an explanation that will fit all the facts, as I was saying to dear Mr. Clement this evening, one cannot advance it with any real conviction. And my own explanation was not quite complete. It lacked just one thing. But suddenly, just as I was leaving Mr. Clement's study, I noticed the palm in the pot by the window, and, well, there the whole thing was, clear as daylight.
Mad,
quite mad,
murmured Melchett to me. But Miss Marple beamed on us serenely and went on in her gentle, ladylike voice.
I was very sorry to believe what I did, very sorry, because I liked them both. But you know what human nature is, and to begin with, when first he and then she both confessed in the most foolish way, well, I was more relieved than I could say. I had been wrong. And I began to think of other people who had a possible motive for wishing Colonel Prothero out of the way.
The seven suspects, I murmured. She smiled at me.
Yes, indeed. There was that man, Archer, not likely, but primed with drink, so inflaming, you never know. And, of course, there was your Mary. She's been walking out with Archer a long time, and she's a queer-tempered girl. Motive and opportunity. Why? She was alone in the house. Old Mrs. Archer could easily have got the pistol from Mr. Redding's house for either of those two. And then, of course, there was Lettice, wanting freedom and money to do as she liked. I've known many cases where the most beautiful and ethereal girls have shown next to no moral scruple, though, of course, gentlemen never wished to believe it of them.
I winced.
And then there was the tennis racket, continued Miss Marple.
The tennis racket?
Yes, the one Mrs. Price Ridley's Clara saw lying on the grass by the vicarage gate. That looked as though Mr. Dennis had got back earlier from his tennis party than he said. Boys of 16 are so very susceptible and so very unbalanced. Whatever the motive, for Lettice's sake or for yours, it was a possibility. Then, of course, there was poor Mr. Hawes and you. Not both of you, naturally, but alternatively, as the lawyers say.
Me? I exclaimed in lively astonishment.
Well, yes, I do apologize, and indeed I never really thought, but there was the question of those disappearing sums of money. Either you or Mr. Hawes must be guilty, and Mrs. Price Ridley was going about everywhere hinting that you were the person in fault, principally because you objected so vigorously to any kind of inquiry into the matter. Of course, I myself was always convinced it was Mr. Hawes. He reminded me so much of that unfortunate organist I mentioned. But all the same, one couldn't be absolutely sure.
Human nature being what it is, I ended grimly.
Exactly. And then, of course, there was dear Griselda.
But Mrs. Clement was completely out of it, interrupted Melchett. She returned by the 6:50 train.
That's what she said, retorted Miss Marple. One should never go by what people say. The 6:50 was half an hour late that night, but at 7:15, I saw her with my own eyes starting for Old Hall. So it followed that she must have come by the earlier train. Indeed, she was seen. But perhaps you know that.
She looked at me inquiringly. Some magnetism in her glance impelled me to hold out the last anonymous letter, the one I had opened so short a time ago. It set out in detail that Griselda had been seen leaving Lawrence Redding's cottage by the back window at 6:20 on the fatal day. I said nothing then, or at any time, of the dreadful suspicion that had for one moment assailed my mind. I had seen it in nightmare terms. A past intrigue between Lawrence and Griselda, the knowledge of it coming to Prothero's ears, his decision to make me acquainted with the facts, and Griselda, desperate, stealing the pistol and silencing Prothero. As I say, a nightmare only, but invested for a few long minutes with a dreadful appearance of reality. I don't know whether Miss Marple had any inkling of all this. Very probably she had. Few things are hidden from her. She handed me back the note with a little nod.
"That's been all over the village," she said. "And it did look rather suspicious, didn't it? Especially with Mrs. Archer swearing at the inquest
that the pistol was still in the cottage when she left at midday. She paused a minute and then went on. But I'm wandering terribly from the point. What I want to say, and believe it my duty, is to put my own explanation of the mystery before you. If you don't believe it, well, I shall have done my best. Even as it is, my wish to be quite sure before I spoke may have cost poor Mr. Hawes his life. Again she paused, and when she resumed, her voice held a different note. It was less apologetic, more decided. That is my own explanation of the facts. By Thursday afternoon, the crime had been fully planned down to the smallest detail. Lawrence Redding first called on the vicar, knowing him to be out. He had with him the pistol, which he concealed in that pot in the stand by the window. When the vicar came in, Lawrence explained his visit by a statement that he had made up his mind to go away. At 5:30, Lawrence Redding telephoned from the North Lodge to the vicar, adopting a woman's voice. You remember what a good amateur actor he was. Mrs. Protheroe and her husband had just started for the village, and, a very curious thing, though no one happened to think of it that way, Mrs. Protheroe took no handbag with her. Really, a most unusual thing for a woman to do. Just before 6:20, she passes my garden and stops and speaks, so as to give me every opportunity of noticing that she has no weapon with her, and also that she is quite her normal self. They realized, you see, that I am a noticing kind of person. She disappears round the corner of the house to the study window. The poor colonel is sitting at the desk writing his letter to you. He is deaf, as we all know. She takes the pistol from the bowl where it is waiting for her, comes up behind him, and shoots him through the head, throws down the pistol and is out again like a flash, going down the garden to the studio. Nearly anyone would swear that there couldn't have been time.
But the shot, objected the colonel. You didn't hear the shot.
There is, I believe, an invention called a Maxim silencer. So I gather from detective stories. I wonder if, possibly, the sneeze that the maid Clara heard might have actually been the shot. But no matter. Mrs. Protheroe is met at the studio by Mr. Redding. They go in together. And human nature being what it is, I'm afraid they realize that I shan't leave the garden till they come out again. I had never liked Miss Marple better than at this moment, with her humorous perception of her own weakness. When they do come out, their demeanour is gay and natural, and there, in reality, they made a mistake, because if they had really said goodbye to each other, as they pretended, they would have looked very different. But you see, that was their weak point. They simply dare not appear upset in any way. For the next 10 minutes, they are careful to provide themselves with what is called an alibi, I believe. Finally, Mr. Redding goes to the vicarage, leaving it as late as he dares. He probably saw you on the footpath from far away and was able to time matters nicely. He picks up the pistol and the silencer, leaves the forged letter with a time on it, written in a different ink and apparently in a different handwriting. When the forgery is discovered, it will look like a clumsy attempt to incriminate Anne Protheroe. But when he leaves the letter, he finds the one actually written by Colonel Protheroe, something quite unexpected. And being a very intelligent young man, and seeing that this letter may come in very useful to him, he takes it away with him. He alters the hands of the clock to the same time as the letter, knowing that it is always kept 1/4 hour fast. The same idea, attempt to throw suspicion on Mrs. Protheroe. Then he leaves, meeting you outside the gate and acting the part of someone nearly distraught. As I say, he is really most intelligent. What would a murderer who had committed a crime try to do? Behave naturally, of course. So, that is just what Mr. Redding does not do. He gets rid of the silencer, but marches into the police station with the pistol and makes a perfectly ridiculous self-accusation which takes everybody in. There was something fascinating in Miss Marple's resume of the case. She spoke with such certainty that we both felt that in this way and in no other could the crime have been committed. "What about the shot heard in the wood?" I asked. "Was that the coincidence to which you were referring earlier this evening?"
"Oh dear, no."
Miss Marple shook her head briskly. "That wasn't a coincidence. Very far from it. It was absolutely necessary that a shot should be heard. Otherwise, suspicion of Mrs. Protheroe might have continued. How Mr. Redding arranged it, I don't quite know. But I understand that picric acid explodes if you drop a weight on it. And you will remember, dear Vicar, that you met Mr. Redding carrying a large stone just in the part of the wood where you picked up that crystal later. Gentlemen are so clever at arranging things. A stone suspended above the crystals, then a time fuse, or do I mean a slow match? Something that would take about 20 minutes to burn through, so that the explosion would come about 6:30 when he and Mrs. Protheroe had come out of the studio and were in full view. A very safe device, because what would there be to find afterwards? Only a big stone. But even that he tried to remove when you came upon him." "I believe you are right," I exclaimed, remembering the start of surprise Lawrence had given on seeing me that day. It had seemed natural enough at the time, but now... Miss Marple seemed to read my thoughts, for she nodded her head shrewdly. "Yes," she said. "It must have been a very nasty shock for him to come across you just then. But he turned it off very well, pretending he was bringing it to me for my rock gardens. Only..." Miss Marple became suddenly very emphatic. "It was the wrong sort of stone for my rock gardens, and that put me on the right track." All this time, Colonel Melchett had sat like a man in a trance. Now he showed signs of coming to. He snorted once or twice, blew his nose in a bewildered fashion, and said,
"Upon my word! Well, upon my word!"
Beyond that, he did not commit himself. I think that he, like myself, was impressed with the logical certainty of Miss Marple's conclusions, but for the moment he was not willing to admit it. Instead, he stretched out a hand, picked up the crumpled letter, and barked out,
"All very well, but how do you account for this fellow Hawes? Why, he actually rang up and confessed!"
"Yes. That was what was so providential. The vicar's sermon, doubtless. You know, dear Mr. Clement, you really preached a most remarkable sermon. It must have affected Mr. Hawes deeply. He could bear it no longer and felt he must confess about the misappropriations of the church funds."
"What?"
"Yes, and that, under providence, is what has saved his life. For I hope and trust it is saved. Dr. Haydock is so clever. As I see the matter, Mr. Redding kept this letter. A risky thing to do, but I expect he hid it in some safe place and waited till he found out for certain to whom it referred. He soon made quite sure that it was Mr. Hawes. I understand he came back here with Mr. Hawes last night and spent a long time with him. I suspect that he then substituted a cachet of his own for one of Mr. Hawes and slipped this letter in the pocket of Mr. Hawes' dressing gown. Poor young man would swallow the fatal cachet in all innocence. After his death, his things would be gone through and the letter found, and everyone would jump to the conclusion that he had shot Colonel Protheroe and taken his own life out of remorse. I rather fancy Mr. Hawes must have found that letter tonight, just after taking the fatal cachet. In his disordered state, it must have seemed like something supernatural, and coming on top of the vicar's sermon, it must have impelled him to confess the whole thing."
"Upon my word," said Colonel Melchett, "upon my word, most extraordinary. I don't believe a word of it."
he had never made a statement that sounded more unconvincing. It must have sounded so in his own ears, for he went on.
And can you explain the other telephone call? The one from Mr. Redding's cottage to Mrs. Price Ridley?
Ah, said Miss Marple, that is what I call the coincidence. Dear Griselda sent that call. She and Mr. Dennis between them, I fancy. They had heard the rumours Mrs. Price Ridley was circulating about the vicar, and they thought of this, perhaps rather childish, way of silencing her. The coincidence lies in the fact that the call should have been put through at exactly the same time as the fake shot from the wood. It led one to believe that the two must be connected. I suddenly remembered how everyone who spoke of that shot had described it as different from the usual shot. They had been right. Yet how hard to explain just in what way the difference of the shot consisted. Colonel Melchett cleared his throat.
Your solution is a very plausible one, Miss Marple, he said. But you will allow me to point out that there is not a shadow of proof.
I know, said Miss Marple. But you believe it to be true, don't you? There was a pause. Then the Colonel said almost reluctantly,
Yes, I do. Dash it all. It's the only way the thing could have happened. But there's no proof. Not an atom.
Miss Marple coughed. That is why I thought perhaps under the circumstances...
Yes?
A little trap might be permissible. Chapter 31 Colonel Melchett and I both stared at her. A trap? What kind of a trap? Miss Marple was a little diffident, but it was clear that she had a plan fully outlined. Supposing Mr. Redding were to be rung up on the telephone and warned? Colonel Melchett smiled.
All is discovered. Fly. That's an old wheeze, Miss Marple. Not that it isn't often successful. But I think in this case young Redding is too downy a bird to be caught that way.
It would have to be something specific, I quite realize that, said Miss Marple. I would suggest, this is just a mere suggestion, that the warning should come from somebody who is known to have rather unusual views on these matters. Dr. Haydock's conversation would lead anyone to suppose that he might view such a thing as murder from an unusual angle. If he were to hint that somebody, Mrs. Sadler, or one of her children, had actually happened to see the transposing of the cachets, well, of course, if Mr. Redding is an innocent man, that statement will mean nothing to him. But if he isn't...
Well, he might just possibly do something foolish. And deliver himself into our hands. It's possible.
Very ingenious, Miss Marple.
But will Haydock stand for it? As you say, his views.
Miss Marple interrupted him brightly. Oh, but that's theory. So very different from practice, isn't it? But anyway, here he is, so we can ask him. Haydock was, I think, rather astonished to find Miss Marple with us. He looked tired and haggard.
It's been a near thing, he said, a very near thing. But he's going to pull through. It's a doctor's business to save his patient, and I saved him. But I'd have been just as glad if I hadn't pulled it off.
You may think differently, said Melchett, when you've heard what we have to tell you.
And briefly and succinctly, he put Miss Marple's theory of the crime before the doctor, ending up with her final suggestion. We were then privileged to see exactly what Miss Marple meant by the difference between theory and practice. Haydock's views appear to have undergone a complete transformation. He would, I think, have liked Lawrence Redding's head on a charger. It was not, I imagine, the murder of Colonel Prothero that so stirred his rancour. It was the assault on the unlucky Hawes.
The damned scoundrel, said Haydock. The damned scoundrel!
That poor devil Hawes. He'd got a mother and a sister too. The stigma of being the mother and sister of a murderer would have rested on them for life. And think of their mental anguish, of all the cowardly, dastardly tricks.
For sheer primitive rage, commend me to a thoroughgoing humanitarian when you get him well roused.
If this thing's true, he said, you can count on me. The fellow's not fit to live. A defenseless chap like Hawes.
A lame dog of any kind can always count on Haydock's sympathy. He was eagerly arranging details with Melchett when Miss Marple rose and I insisted on seeing her home.
"It is most kind of you, Mr. Clement," said Miss Marple, as we walked down the deserted street. "Dear me, past 12 o'clock. I hope Raymond has gone to bed and not waited up."
"He should have accompanied you," I said.
"I didn't let him know I was going," said Miss Marple.
I smiled suddenly as I remembered Raymond West's subtle psychological analysis of the crime. "If your theory turns out to be the truth, which I for one do not doubt for a minute," I said, "you will have a very good score over your nephew." Miss Marple smiled also, an indulgent smile.
"I remember a saying of my great Aunt Fanny's. I was 16 at the time, and thought it particularly foolish."
"Yes?" I inquired.
"She used to say, 'The young people think the old people are fools, but the old people know the young people are fools.'"
Chapter 32. There is little more to be told. Miss Marple's plan succeeded. Lawrence Redding was not an innocent man, and the hint of a witness of the change of capsule did indeed cause him to do something foolish. Such is the power of an evil conscience. He was, of course, peculiarly placed. His first impulse, I imagine, must have been to cut and run. But there was his accomplice to consider. He could not leave without getting word to her, and he dared not wait till morning. So he went up to Old Hall that night, and two of Colonel Melchett's most efficient officers followed him. He threw gravel at Anne Prothero's window, aroused her, and an urgent whisper brought her down to speak with him. Doubtless they felt safer outside than in, with the possibility of Lettice waking. But as it happened, the two police officers were able to overhear the conversation in full. It left the matter in no doubt. Miss Marple had been right on every count. The trial of Lawrence Redding and Anne Prothero is a matter of public knowledge. I do not propose to go into it. I will only mention that great credit was reflected upon Inspector Slack, whose zeal and intelligence had resulted in the criminals being brought to justice. Naturally, nothing was said of Miss Marple's share in the business. She herself would have been horrified at the thought of such a thing. Lettice came to see me just before the trial took place. She drifted through my study window, wraith-like as ever. She told me then that she had all along been convinced of her stepmother's complicity. The loss of the yellow beret had been a mere excuse for searching the study. She hoped against hope that she might find something the police had overlooked.
"You see," she said in her dreamy voice, "they didn't hate her like I did, and hate makes things easier for you."
Disappointed in the result of her search, she had deliberately dropped Anne's earring by the desk.
"Since I knew she had done it, what did it matter? One way was as good as another. She had killed him."
I sighed a little. There are always some things that Lettice will never see. In some respects, she is morally colourblind. "What are you going to do, Lettice?" I asked.
When it's all over, I am going abroad."
She hesitated and then went on.
"I am going abroad with my mother."
I looked up, startled. She nodded.
"Didn't you ever guess? Mrs. Lestrange is my mother. She is dying, you know.
She wanted to see me, and so she came down here under an assumed name. Dr. Haydock helped her. He's a very old friend of hers. He was keen about her once. You can see that. In a way, he still is. Men always went batty about Mother, I believe. She's awfully attractive, even now. Anyway, Dr. Haydock did everything he could to help her. She didn't come down here under her own name because of the disgusting way people talk and gossip. She went to see Father that night and told him she was dying and had a great longing to see something of me. Father was a beast. He said she'd forfeited all claim that I thought she was dead, as though I had ever swallowed that story. Men like Father never see an inch before their noses. But Mother is not the sort to give in. She thought it only decent to go to Father first, but when he turned her down so brutally, she sent a note to me, and I arranged to leave the tennis party early and meet her at the end of the footpath at 6:15. We just had a hurried meeting and arranged when to meet again. We left each other before 6:30. Afterwards, I was terrified that she would be suspected of having killed Father. After all, she had got a grudge against him. That's why I got hold of that old picture of her up in the attic and slashed it about. I was afraid the police might go nosing about and get hold of it and recognize it. Dr. Haydock was frightened too. Sometimes, I believe, he really thought she had done it. Mother is rather a desperate kind of person. She doesn't count consequences. She paused. It's queer. She and I belong to each other. Father and I didn't. But Mother, well, anyway, I'm going abroad with her. I shall be with her till the end. She got up and I took her hand. God bless you both, I said. Someday, I hope there is a lot of happiness coming to you, Lettice. There should be, she said, with an attempt at a laugh. There hasn't been much so far, has there? Oh, well, I don't suppose it matters. Goodbye, Mr. Clement. You've been frightfully decent to me always, you and Griselda. Griselda? I had to own to her how terribly the anonymous letter had upset me, and first she laughed, and then solemnly read me a lecture. However, she added, I'm going to be very sober and God-fearing in future, quite like the Pilgrim Fathers. I did not see Griselda in the role of a Pilgrim Father. She went on, You see, Len, I have a steadying influence coming into my life. It's coming into your life, too, but in your case, it will be a kind of rejuvenating one. At least I hope so. You can't call me a dear child half so much when we have a real child of our own. And, Len, I've decided that now I'm going to be a real wife and mother, as they say in books. I must be a housekeeper, too. I bought 2 books on household management and 1 on mother love, and if that doesn't turn me out of pattern, I don't know what will. They are all simply screamingly funny, not intentionally, you know, especially the one about bringing up children. You haven't bought a book on how to treat a husband, have you? I asked with sudden apprehension as I drew her to me. I don't need to, said Griselda. I'm a very good wife. I love you dearly. What more do you want? Nothing, I said. Could you say, just for once, that you love me madly? Griselda, I said, I adore you. I worship you. I am wildly, hopelessly, and quite unclerically crazy about you. My wife gave a deep and contented sigh. Then she drew away suddenly. Bother! Here's Miss Marple coming. Don't let her suspect, will you? I don't want everyone offering me cushions and urging me to put my feet up. Tell her I've gone down to the golf links. That will put her off the scent, and it's quite true because I left my yellow pullover there and I want it. Miss Marple came to the window, halted apologetically, and asked for Griselda. Griselda, I said, has gone to the golf links. An expression of concern leapt into Miss Marple's eyes.
Oh, but surely, she said, that is most unwise, just now.
And then, in a nice old-fashioned ladylike maiden-lady way, she blushed. And to cover the moment's confusion, we talked hurriedly of the Prothero case and of Dr. Stone, who had turned out to be a well-known cracksman with several different aliases. Miss Cram, by the way, had been cleared of all complicity. She had at last admitted taking the suitcase to the wood, but had done so in all good faith, Dr. Stone having told her that he feared the rivalry of other archaeologists who would not stick at burglary to gain their object of discrediting his theories. The girl apparently swallowed this not very plausible story. She is now, according to the village, looking out for a more genuine article in the line of an elderly bachelor requiring a secretary. As we talked, I wondered very much how Miss Marple had discovered our latest secret. But presently, in a discreet fashion, Miss Marple herself supplied me with a clue. "I hope dear Griselda is not overdoing it," she murmured, and after a discreet pause, "I was in the bookshop in Much Benham yesterday."
Poor Griselda. That book on mother love has been her undoing.
"I wonder, Miss Marple," I said suddenly, "if you were to commit a murder, whether you would ever be found out."
"What a terrible idea," said Miss Marple, shocked. "I hope I could never do such a wicked thing."
"But human nature being what it is," I murmured.
Miss Marple acknowledged the hit with a pretty old ladyish laugh.
"Ah, how naughty of you, Mr. Clement."
She rose.
"But naturally, you are in good spirits."
She paused by the window.
"My love to dear Griselda, and tell her that any little secret is quite safe with me."
Really, Miss Marple is rather a dear.
We hope you have enjoyed The Murder at the Vicarage by Agatha Christie, performed by Richard E. Grant. This programme was directed by Ali Muirden. It was recorded at Strathmore Studios, London. Produced by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Karen Jakonski. Text copyright, 1930, Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright, 2012, HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.